And we turn now to the new Talk of the Nation opinion page. Every Sunday, newspapers around the country feature opinion pieces opposite the editorial page or in special sections. Every Monday, we'll have one of those authors on to take your calls about his or her argument. This week, we feature Kanan Makiya's piece from the op-ed page of the Sunday New York Times Week in Review section. Kanan Makiya fled Saddam Hussein's Iraq and wrote the books Republic of Fear and Cruelty and Science and Silence. He's now a professor at Brandeis University, the president and the founder of the Iraq Memory Foundation. In his piece yesterday, he argued that the national parliament that's elected on Thursday must rewrite parts of the Constitution or face the prospect of civil war. If you have questions for Kanan Makiya about the power of the central government and the regions, about sectarian and ethnic divisions in Iraq, about the future of that country, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. And Kanan Makiya joins us now from the BBC studios in London. And Professor Makiya, nice to have you back on the program.
Very nice to talk to you again, Neil.
First of all, I know that you prefer not to be identified by ethnicity or by sect, but as Iraqi as a rule. However, to clarify the perspective for this article was written from, you are a Shia.
That is correct.
And why is
an
that?
An Arab Shia.
An Arab Shia. And why is that important?
As I say, to me it's not, but it's important because, as I think your previous speakers have said, identity politics has become the dominant tenor of politics in the last in the course of the last 2 years in Iraq, and so everybody wants to know what you are. As many friends of mine, for instance, in Baghdad University, have said, really quite shocking. They're very critical of the existing government, which is dominated, as your speakers have said, by the Shiites and the United Iraqi Alliance, but they feel they feel that they have to vote because their identity is involved. That is explicitly what somebody said to me, professor of political science at Baghdad University. I was quite shocked at this. But it underlines how identity politics has risen to the fore in Iraq in this election campaign.
And in part, your identification is important because your article argues in part that this constitution shortchanges the Sunnis.
That's correct.
And how does it do that?
It does that in a number of ways. Firstly, there are some explicitly unjust articles. For instance, Article 109 provides for extra expenditure in those provinces that have oil in them. That is directly targeted at the Sunnis, who have no oil in the provinces in which they constitute a majority. And so they are bound to feel that they are being penalized by that particular clause, but it does so in more complex ways. It's not that the Constitution was deliberately written to target Sunnis. It's that once it was written, I think the predominant tenor of it was written against tyranny. It was written in a state of reaction to the 34 years of Saddam's regime. And so in their attempt to get rid of a possible future authoritarian state, a strong man, as Phoebe Marr said earlier, they have, so to speak, bent, the pendulum has swung too far in the opposite direction. And the central state emerges out of this constitution as a very, very weak, possibly even failing body. That central state is something that historically was associated with Sunnis. That is, the Iraqi state has been around for some 80 years since the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, and Sunnis have dominated that state. Shiites and Kurds have stayed away from politics. They have felt repulsed by it. They have chosen free professions, or they have distanced themselves. They have tried not to get involved in the army and so on. And so now, when you have a constitution that, in a state of reaction to that, essentially weakens the state almost beyond repair, it seems to me this is not so much, I'm not arguing for Sunnis, I'm arguing for restoring power to the state. There are many ways in which that does that. For instance, the executive is internally inconsistent with one another. The way it is set up, the president and the prime minister are going to be at permanent war with one another. That's a completely untenable situation. We have a civil war, we have an insurgency to fight, and we have a country to rebuild, and we have all sorts of huge major projects. And that can't be done with a weakened state, weakened to the point of failure.
When we come back from a short break, we're going to continue talking with Kanan Makia, who's on the Talk of the Nation opinion page this morning. And again, if you'd like to get a look at his article that appeared on the op-ed page of the New York Times Week in Review section yesterday, there's a link to it on our website. That's npr.org, and click down to the Talk of the Nation page. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have questions about what he's talking about, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We'll be back after the break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking with Kanan Makia about the future of Iraq. Mr. Makia is president of the Iraq Memory Foundation and author of The Republic of Fear, The Politics of Modern Iraq, and of Cruelty and Silence. More recently, of course, the author of an op-ed article in yesterday's New York Times Week in Review section. That's what we're talking about today. And Kanan Makia, the way you discuss the weakness of the Iraqi central government, it is weak as opposed to very strong regional authorities that the Constitution sets up.
That's true, Neil. The third big problem with the Constitution is that it creates a dynamic for the creation of regions. Now, in Iraq, we really have only one part of Iraq in which the conditions for a federal region exists, is Kurdistan. Everywhere else, the country has been atomized under 30 years of dictatorship, and it's simply not ready yet. Federalism and the formation of separate regions, which have great powers according to the Constitution, really powers even to prevent the army from crossing through its territories, powers to develop oil revenues, as we said earlier, mm-hmm. powers to run all the local day-to-day laws that matter in everyday people's lives, and powers to block central government left, right, and center. In these issues of the powers of the regions, the power of the separate provinces, the Constitution is very explicit. But there is a powerful dynamic to create these regions. Populist politicians abound in the wake of the December elections. Very quickly, start to organize themselves to form these regions. I worry that in the way that dynamic is put out in the Constitution, and with the very weak safeguards and the lack of clear working out of the powers that are held by the federal government versus the regional governments or the local governments, the center stands to lose steadily at the expense of the regions. Now, in principle, there's nothing wrong with very strong regions. In fact, I am a very strong supporter of federalism. I've been one of the most ardent Arab supporters of a federal solution to the problem of the state of Iraq. But the pendulum has swung too far, as I said, largely as a reaction to 30 years of tyranny and central authority from Baghdad downwards.
Well, it seems that there's a problem. As you say, Kurdistan has been autonomous since 1991 and has been running its own affairs, and the Kurds were going to insist on as much autonomy as they could get. It seems to me the Constitution writers had a problem of saying, either you're going to make the Kurds the exception, in other words, here are the rules for everybody except the Kurds, or you're going to say, we're going to have this idea of regionalism as a principle, what's good for the Kurds could be good for the Shias or the Sunnis.
Yes, but the Constitution does not set any conditions for becoming a region. If you thought through what federalism meant and what are the conditions that have to be fulfilled by groups of provinces that want to become a region, then clearly Kurdistan would have fit those conditions and other parts of Iraq would not. The drive towards regionalism, the sort of thinking behind the Constitution, has largely been a selfish one of the provinces that Shiite provinces, in particular Kurdish provinces, holding on to whatever resource they have at the expense of the resource-poor provinces of the Sunni provinces. Now, the real problem here is not a problem of the Kurds, and it's not a problem of the Sunnis. It's the problem of the Shiite leadership in Iraq, it seems to me. The big effort to bring the Sunnis into politics has succeeded, by and large, since the January elections, the process that was referred to by your earlier speakers. So the issue, however, is that the Shiite leadership, which is a natural democratic majority, needs and is to behave in a way and to speak in a way that is, let us say, in which it carries the responsibility of its own numbers. This is not what is happening. Instead, that majority, while it has not, it is true, lashed out, there have not been reactions to the very many provocative attempts to instigate reactions amongst the Kurds and the Shiites in Iraq, the provocations of the insurgents I'm talking about, blowing up mosques, chopping off Kurdish taxi drivers' heads in Mosul and then filming them and sending it off to Kurdish television stations in order to provoke Kurdish unhappiness and so on. These kinds of measures to provoke the Shiites and the Kurds of Iraq have thus far not led to huge communal reactions. But the leadership that has emerged out of the Shiite majority in particular has increasingly insisted on a Shiite form of identity. As we talked earlier, as we began speaking, it is identity politics that's the dominant tenor of discourse. This has created a problem for many of the other minorities of Iraq. Nobody is speaking in the name of the country as a whole, and that is reflected in the fact that the central state, too, does not have anyone speaking for it, except groups that are not likely to get a very large majority of seats. So this is a problem, and it does not lead to a consensual agreement among the different parts of Iraq to break up, but in an agreed-upon fashion, which would be perfectly okay, in my opinion. It is a recipe for more violence down the line, I fear.
Let's get a caller in on the conversation. And again, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, or email us totn@npr.org. And Matt is on the phone. Matt calling from Las Vegas.
Yeah, hi. I guess I'm having a hard time understanding why Iraq is being kept together as a single state. It seems like we spent most of the 1990s watching states like this, where you have these very sort of different groups stuck together, you know, either breaking up like in Europe or committing genocide like in Africa. And I guess I'd just like to hear why people are working so hard to keep Iraq together, and I'll take the answer off the air.
Or both in the case of Yugoslavia, but Kanan Mikia.
You're right.
Well, Iraq has, as a political entity, as a frontier, has been around since the fall of the Ottoman Empire. One should be very, very careful, it seems to me, in politics to throw the baby out with the bathwater. It is not that one is wedded to the natural boundaries of Iraq, because there's nothing natural about the way they were originally formed. But 80 years is a very long period of time, and habits and cultures and commonalities develop across these boundaries. If there was, as I said earlier, a consensual breakup of this state, that would be fine. But if it leads to far more violence down the line and many, many bodies in the course of this breakup, that is a case for not throwing away the state too soon. The Kurds understand that very well. The Kurds have every reason in the world to ask for a separate state. They were betrayed in the early formation of Iraq. They were and the formation of the Middle East at the hands of the great powers, Britain and France. They were left out with nothing, basically. And until this very day, the Kurdish leadership understands the dangers of just suddenly going their own way. It's not just regional pressures and powers. It's also the realization that Kurdish interests may not lie in a sudden fracturing of Iraq, unless it were very carefully worked out. None of that is what is going on. So it seems I argue for a state based on a great deal of autonomy and decentralization, yes, and but a decentralization that is worked out, in which the rules of in which the laws that govern this, that what the parts have power over and what the center has, are very carefully worked out. The Constitution, as it stands, is more like a party political statement. It's a very interesting and very important document, historically speaking, because it does throw away that original state of 80 years ago, and it does truly inject something new into Middle Eastern politics. But it hasn't worked through the problems of that new entity that it is creating. And so what I'm arguing for, essentially, in this piece is the desperate need to sort those problems out between what is in the province, what is under the power of the federal government, what is in the power of the provinces, and how the whole thing is going to work. At the moment, it doesn't work.
Let's get another caller in. This is Wade. Wade calling us from, Roswell, New Mexico?
Roseville, California.
Roseville, California. Go ahead.
Thanks for having me on. I've been a member for about 10 years, and I really appreciate your show.
Well, thank you for that.
I'd just like to ask Dr. McKay, on Article 2, where it states that Islam is the official religion of the state and is a basic source of legislation and that no law can be passed that contradicts the undisputed rules of Islam, that's a quote. How does that relate to democracy? And I'll take the answer off there, too.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Wade.
Very good question. The original version of my article, which is appearing in Arabic, includes a long discussion of that point as well, but it would have made the article far too long for the pages of the New York Times. But I address that point explicitly. As the Constitution stands at the moment, there is another clear contradiction. There are two sets of principles asserted. One is a principle of human rights and individual rights. These are elaborated upon at great length. And the second is Islam being a source of legislation. By the way, the way the articles are formulated in Arabic, there's sufficient room for doubt. You could almost say it's the source of legislation, a source of legislation. Very clever linguists have worked out these formulations so as to leave all that doubt and ambiguity present. What I think is needed, desperately needed, again, is to, in other words, you have in the Constitution two separate visions of Iraq, one in which Islamic Sharia plays a major role in legislation, and the other in which individual rights, human rights, and liberal democracy is set in place. Both are equally articulated. That's the paradox. That's what makes this document so unworkable. What would be very helpful is if in the second round, because the Constitution allows for amendments to be made in the first 4 months or so following the establishment of a committee right after the meeting of the first meeting of the Parliament, among those amendments should be an attempt to explicitly state that the interpretation of Islam that Iraqis agree upon does not violate the individual human rights that are mentioned in this constitution. That, by the way, would be a very, very bold move. In other words, again, what Iraqis have done is they have laid out two things that are very important to them. And if it were possible for the constitution to be amended so as to say, you know, whatever may be anybody else's interpretation of Islam out there, we in this constitution and people are going to vote on these amendments as well, say that this, our interpretation of Islam, is that it does not contradict with individual human rights. That would be a major breakthrough in Middle Eastern Arab and Muslim politics in general. I don't know if that's possible, but that's what I argue should take place.
And where does the Arabic version of this article appear?
Well, it hasn't appeared yet, but I'm hoping it's going to be a tomorrow, the day after. It's going to appear, I hope, in Sharq al-Awsat.
Okay. We're talking with Kanan Makia, professor at Brandeis University, the founder of the Iraq Memory Foundation, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Kanan Makia earlier said that thus far the Shias have not responded to the provocations of many in the Sunni community in Iraq, the beheadings of Kurdish cab drivers, as you put it, and obviously the blowing up of mosques and that sort of thing. Yet we do read of death squads in Iraqi interior ministry uniforms carrying out revenge killings of numbers of largely men found with their arms tied behind the back and a bullet through their heads, Sunni men. At least a low-level civil war already seems to be underway.
Hello?
Yes?
Yes, sorry, I just got cut off for a second.
Oh, I apologize. We were talking about...
I understand. You said low-level civil war is effectively taking place in Iraq.
Yes.
I agree. And I think that is a danger to come. What I meant was whole neighborhoods have not yet turned against other neighborhoods. That is, this is still, in a sense, the main parties, are organizing these death squads on all sides. So it is still executions. It's very dangerous. Yes, it virtually is a civil war at the moment. But when I say civil war, I mean the kind of thing we saw in Lebanon, where one community was daily at war with the other, has not yet happened. In fact, it's been quite remarkable the degree of restraint that the Shiite provinces in particular have shown. It does show that there is an enormous reservoir of tolerance, of understanding that these issues are provocations and not to be lashed back at. The failure here is not of the population at large, is I guess what I'm trying to say. It is of the politicians.
Mm-hmm. Another issue of the opinion poll that was done by ABC News that is out, over the past couple of days, shows a widespread belief that people would like the occupation by American and other countries' forces to end soon. Yet it also shows some optimism for the future of Iraq, and that in itself is pretty interesting.
It is. I think one of the most interesting figures, I'm not aware of that particular poll, but I know of a BBC poll just taken recently, which shows over 70% of Iraqis remain incredibly optimistic about the situation. And while they think things are very bad at the moment, and especially security is on their minds, they remain optimistic. That, is, I think, is the single most important poll or statistic to watch. somehow or another, people have managed, in spite of all the terrible things that have happened, in spite of all the anarchy and chaos of Baghdad and Iraq at the moment, to retain this sense that their lives are going to get better. In their, so to speak, in their deeper instincts, they feel that 30 years of dictatorship, there's going to be some chaos, some anarchy after 30 years of dictatorship. And in normal conversation with Iraqis, you always get this sense, look, we always knew it was going to be messy.
Mm-hmm.
But and that has held up for a very, very long period of time. There's a lot of hope to be found there. The public, the problem, again, I say, it's not in the public at large. They have remarkable resilience. They have shown great support for the democratic project in general, while critical, while being very critical of the American, of many actions that the United States did inside Iraq. That both of those things have held in GOV. Again, the politicians have let them down.
Well, by President Bush's estimate today, 30,000 Iraqis have been killed since the U.S. invasion started. And, of course, 2,140 American troops as well. Of course, there are forces from around the world also on that list. But are Iraqis asking themselves at this point, was it worth it?
My sense is that, by and large, they all think, yes, definitely, it still was worth it. Nobody has turned around and said in any large numbers anything else other than the insurgents, of course. But the anger at the chaos is growing, and the need for a strong man or the call for some sense of solving the security question is there. What the reason why I wrote this piece is that we will not have that improvement in the security situation without a strong government. This is something that we've had three wonderful elections. We have had an enormously exciting political process in that country for 1 year, including the discussion on the constitution. Whatever criticism I might have, this was a genuine constitution. That's what makes it so interesting. That's why people need to write about it. But what we still don't have is the barest elements of day-to-day, daily life security inside the country. That is an extremely troubling factor, which will play out in the long run and which will move against democracy in the long run until it's solved. And the only way you can solve that is no longer even an American problem. It is today an Iraqi problem. The only way you can solve that is a central government that takes that into hand and that worries about the militias. Because part of the problem you were alluding to earlier is it's not just that our police forces are not doing so well, whatever. It's that militias run large portions of the security. Militias have entered into the police forces, corrupted even the good work that was done in the early stages.
Kanan Makiya's piece is called Present at the Disintegration. It appeared in yesterday's New York Times Week in Review section. If you'd like to read it, you can find a link to it at npr.org on the Talk of the Nation webpage. And Kanan Makiya, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
Kanan Makiya, professor at Brandeis University, author of Cruelty and Science, Silence, War, Tyranny, Uprising, and the Arab World. He joined us from the studios of the BBC in London, England. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan.